I offer to go first because that way I can choose which way to go so she doesn't have to worry about it. I'm clearing the way and people are gawking, and it hits me that up until recently, I was one of them. Maybe not the snickering ones, but the ones sitting next to them. I don't know what to feel or do, so I stare back. Do I know them or not know them? I don't even care. They're watching her and me and this table of boys start saying shit. Does she hear them? I can't tell, probably. I throw my head back, a move I like to think makes my hair instantly grow 20 times bigger and me 10 feet taller, and I give them the eye. They get quiet. Upstairs, Libby takes a seat on the swing, and now I can sit on the other side of the table, or I can sit next to her. I think, fuck 'em all. These people who are staring. I say, is that space taken? I nod down at the swing. You don't have to. What? Sit by me. Move it, sister. She shoves over and we rock back and forth, like we're kicking back on our front porch on a summer afternoon. Each table has an actual phone, the old-fashioned kind with a cord. And after I call in our order, I take her hand. I say, my palms are sweaty. Why? I'm nervous. Why? Because I'm sitting next to you on this swing and you're beautiful. She hesitates, like she's not sure whether to take the compliment. But then she says, thank you. Being out in the world with her is different from being alone with her. For one, there are too many other people. For two, I'm on guard, ready to take on anyone who tries to get it started with her or me. For three, it's making me think about her weight in a way I haven't really truly thought about until right this moment. We're sitting there in silence, so I decide to tell her about Dr. Amber Klein and the tests and everything I haven't told her about my time as Jack Maslin, lab rat. Libby's not saying anything, but I can tell she's listening. Her head is cocked to one side, and I can see her eyes taking it all in. Finally, she goes, how do you feel? The same. Maybe a little worse. Maybe a little better. Are you going to tell your parents? I don't think so. What's the point, right? I mean, there's nothing any of us can do short of downloading facial recognition software directly into this brain of mine. Telling them won't magically create a cure. It'll just give them more shit to worry about. I'm sorry. I wanted there to be something they could do for you. Not because your brain isn't awesome the way it is, but because it would make you feel better. Now it's my turn to not say anything. I sit looking at her until it's just us. Libby and me. No one else for miles. What I want to do more than anything is kiss her. I almost do, but then the waitress is standing there with our food. As we eat, Libby is glancing around, and finally she looks at me and goes, Richmond, huh? And there's something in her tone that makes me set down my drink. I thought you'd like Clarice. I do like Clarice. It's just that I would have been okay, you know, going somewhere in Amos. And then she stares off toward the bus. I say, listen, I may be keeping the face blindness a secret for now, but that doesn't mean I want everything in my life to be a secret. It doesn't mean I want to keep you a secret. I would never hide you away if that's what you're thinking. As I say it, I ask myself, is that what I'm doing? She starts blinking at the table, at the menu, anywhere else but at me. Holy shit. That's what you were thinking. That I brought you out here so we wouldn't run into anyone.
No.
Good. Because that would be crazy. So why did you bring her here, asshole?
I mean, yes.
Because that wouldn't be crazy at all. Now her eyes find mine. Okay, I say. I get it. I'm King Douchelord, and you trust me, but you don't. You don't know me well enough to know how deep the douchery goes. The whole while I'm asking myself, how deep does the douchery go? What if it goes deeper than you think? She says, maybe not. And I hate the careful, closed-off tone, because it's like a fence between us. Listen, I brought you here because you're better than some shitty Amos chain restaurant. I brought you here because when I was six, I fell off the roof of our house, and my dad smuggled a Clara's pizza into the hospital. And those kinds of memories are pretty rare for me right now. The ones where my dad is this really great guy. I brought you here because this is the first place I wanted to go after I got out of the hospital and was well enough to sit up straight. I brought you here because it's one of the few places in a 60-mile radius, if not the entire state of Indiana, that isn't boring or typical. Because you're not boring or typical. And I realize every word is true. I reach over the fence and take her hand. I kiss the knuckles one by one. As I do, I'm thinking, how does this girl mean so much to me? Libby Strout, you deserve to be seen. People can't help but see me. She says this to the tablecloth. That's not what I mean. We sit there swinging, and now I'm kicking myself for bringing her here. I should have just gone to Red Lobster, where we could have been stared at by everyone at school, including maybe Caroline, and where my idiot friends could have come over and hijacked our date with their stupidity. I say, wait here. And then I'm up and out of the swing, down the stairs and over to the jukebox, which hugs the wall behind the bus. This is the same jukebox my parents used to play when they were coming here on dates about 60 years ago. As I'm flipping through the musical choices, I'm thinking about how Libby Strout makes me want to drive 30 miles to the closest place that is almost good enough for her, and run through crowded restaurants to find her the perfect song. And then I see it. The Jackson 5. I choose the song I was looking for, and also a couple of others. Sly and the Family Stone, Earth, Wind, and Fire, so we can have a whole block of them. Then I go back to the table, which is the table in the upper northwest corner, the one with the girl in the purple dress. She says, you didn't have to do that. You don't have to do anything. I'm being dumb. You could never be dumb. I can be dumb. She takes a bite of pizza. I take a bite of pizza. We eat in this weird silence. And then suddenly, the song is playing. As in, the song. I wipe my mouth with a napkin and toss it aside. I'm on my feet, hand out. Libby blinks up at me. What? Come on. Where? Just come on. And I lead her down the stairs to the center of Clara's, right to the one open spot at the front of the restaurant, near the entrance to the dining room. Then I spin her into my arms, and we're dancing. Oh, so slowly. I'll Be There is the obvious choice, but the one I chose is Ben. If ever a song was written for Libby and me, it's this one. Two broken, lonely people who maybe aren't so broken or lonely anymore. At first, I'm aware of every eye in the room on us, but then all the faces fade away, and it's just Libby and me. My hands on her waist. All that woman in my arms. We're in perfect sync, moving together, making it up as we go.
Libby. I can feel the tears burning against the backs of my eyes. Every line is me, Libby Strout. It's us, but mostly me. And also Jack. God. I could cry in the arms of Jack Maslin as an entire restaurant of strangers watches, or I could push the tears back and down until they're buried. I push them, and push them, I won't let them out. At some point, he leans in and just like that, without a word, kisses my face. First one cheek, and then the other. He kisses me where the tears would be if I'd let them fall, and it's the single loveliest thing anyone has ever done who wasn't my mom. Suddenly, I'm filled with the safe, warm feeling that I haven't felt in a really long time. It's the feeling of everything is going to be okay. You are going to be okay. You may already be okay. Let's us be okay together. Just you and me. I suck in my breath and don't breathe again until the song is over. The jukebox goes jumping right into the next track, which is a fast one, thank goodness, and that's when Jack breaks out the moves. He says, "Get a load of this girl, if you can handle it." And he is grooving all over the place. "Handle this!" And I'm dancing too, till we're dancing like lunatics, and I don't feel like crying anymore, ever again. He goes, "Do the exploding hair!" And he shakes his head to the left, to the right, to the middle. He has an unfair advantage because his hair is so much bigger, but I do my best to shake my hair all around. I go, "Do the lightning strike!" And I jump and shake, like I'm being electrified. He starts jumping and shaking too, and at some point, I look around and a handful of other people are on their feet and dancing at their tables. Jack says, "It's a dance revolution." He takes my hand and twirls me round and round, so that I'm spinning like a top and laughing. I think what an amazing world this would be if we all danced everywhere we went. He walks me to the front door of my house, and when we get there, I wait for him to kiss me goodnight. But instead, he hugs me. This isn't a fat girl rodeo hug. It's warm and enveloping in a good way, and I can smell the soap and outdoors on him, like he rolled in fresh grass. I want him to hold me forever. But then he pulls away and gazes down at me with half-closed eyes. "Good night, Libby." And I say, "Good night, Jack." And I go inside, and my dad is there, and I tell him about the dinner, and then I go to my room and close the door and sit on the bed and think, why the hell didn't he want to kiss me? My phone buzzes. "Best date ever," followed by, "I can't wait to do it again," followed by, "This chick Mary Catherine really reminds you of us? From what I can tell, she's pretty much bats in the belfry." I write, "Yes, but in a kind of lovable way. She's got this big secret and no one understands her." "Does that help you make the connection?" He writes back, "Oh, I didn't say I don't see the connection. But tell me you don't think we're that crazy." Me, "I think we're even crazier." Jack, "I'll buy that." A few minutes later, he writes, "I can't stop reading. This may be the best birthday present I've ever gotten, next to the soldering iron they gave me when I turned 9. Me, "That's what I like about you. So manly, yet so cerebral." Jack, "Those are only two of the many, many things you like about me, and don't get me started on what I like about you. I'll never get this book read, and it's my life's mission to finish it tonight." He texts me off and on through the rest of the night, giving me a running commentary on what he's reading. Eventually, I fall back into the pillows, a big, loopy smile on my face. He may not have kissed me after our date, but it's almost definitely, undeniably, absolutely guaranteed that he will.
Jack. Monday morning, a tall girl with dark skin and a painted-on beauty mark finds me at my locker.
Jack?
Caroline. Yes. Just in case it isn't her, but some other tall girl with dark skin and a painted-on beauty mark by one eye.
Did you have a good weekend?
Thanks for asking. Yes, I did.
You know what people are saying, don't you?
And here it comes. That I'm one badass dude?
About that girl? That Libby Strout and you? They're saying you're dating her, that she's your new girlfriend. I was like, I know that can't be true. But they're like, no, it's true. He took her to Clara's.
Who is they?
It doesn't matter.
I can hear the hurt in her voice, buried underneath all the venom. I want to say, it's okay to be a person. We're all afraid. We all get hurt. It's okay to hurt. You'd be so much more likable if you just acted human. We're not together anymore, Caroline, so, not to be rude, but why do you care?
I think it's sweet that you want to be nice to her after what you did, but I'm just concerned about her. Girls like that, you can't mess around with them, Jack.
She shakes her head.
You could end up breaking her heart.
We haven't defined anything yet, but if you're asking me if I like hanging out with her, absolutely. And do I think she's one cool chick? Yes. Do I think she's beautiful? Yeah, I do. I really do. I'm not messing around with her. I like her. Any other questions? She stands there, perfectly composed, perfectly Caroline, and says,
You know, you think you're all that. You pretend to be all that, but you're not.
I know I'm not.
Which is all the more reason I'm grateful she likes me anyway.
At home, I dig through the pile of clothes on my floor until I come up with the jeans I'm looking for. I pull the ball of wadded-up paper out of the back pocket. Top 10 reasons to date a fat girl. I make myself reread it. It's like I need to prove to myself once and for all that she's fat and I don't care. Every word of the article makes me sick. How could I ever feel anything but lucky that this girl likes me? I go downstairs to the kitchen, walk directly to the stove, turn on one of the burners, and wave the paper over the gas flame till it catches fire. I hold the paper up and away from the stove and watch as the words burn away. And then I drop what's left of the paper into the sink, where it burns itself into a pile of ashes. I turn on the faucet and wash the remains down the drain, and for good measure, flick the switch to the garbage disposal and let it grind. Back in my room, I call Libby. When she answers, I say, I finished the book.
And?
One, it was pretty damn terrifying. Two, Mary Catherine Blackwood was mad as a fucking hatter. Three, I see why you love it. Four, it might have reminded me of us just a little. Although I'd like to argue that we're slightly more sane. And five, I think it would be pretty fucking awesome to live in a castle with you.
Libby. In my nightstand, underneath my headphones, my lip balm, and an assortment of bookmarks, I pull out a letter written on Christmas stationery. These are for dancing alone on stage, or in your room, or anywhere your heart desires. They are for dancing in your dreams. Dancing toward your future. Dancing in love and creativity and joy. Dancing because that is what you do. Because that's who you are, no matter what, inside and outside. You just keep on dancing. The shoes that came with this letter are in my closet. They're from the Christmas before my mom died. They will always be the last present I ever get from her, and I need to keep them safe forever, which is why I've never worn them. But right now I'm sitting down and pulling apart the tissue paper and taking the shoes out of their box and tying them on my feet. They are pink ballet toe shoes, and they are the loveliest thing I own. Even though she bought them too big, they're too small for me now and hard to walk in. But I shuffle over to my laptop and turn on some music. I'm going old school with the Spice Girls, a band my mom secretly loved. The song is, Who Do You Think You Are? And it makes me think of my mom, of me, of where I might go one day, of what I might be. My damsel's audition is Saturday. I know my routine by heart. I could do it in my sleep. But right now, I do my own made-up dance that's kind of a ballet, hip-hop, electric slide, shimmy pop, and I am amazing. I am the best dancer ever. I am a superstar. The shoes are magic. My feet are magic. I am magic. Saturday.
Jack. Marcus, tall, shaggy hair, pointy chin, stands over the kitchen sink, shoveling food into his face. I start to help myself to the coffee, and that's when I hear, "I said no." A woman walks in, followed by a man wearing an official Maslin store shirt. His mouth is open in mid-sentence, but he closes it when he sees Marcus and me. By process of elimination, these are my parents. Mom says to me, "Put the coffee down now," then says to my dad, "We'll talk about it later." And it's clear they're in the middle of an argument. I reach for the largest mug we have and pour myself a cup of coffee. Mom asks Dad just what does he want her to do, and she sounds like she's swallowing razor blades. Like the guy at Sad Carnival, as we call it, the one out by Big Lots. I try not to eavesdrop. I can feel my whole body go on alert, the way it always does when they argue. Dad says to my mom, "Tonight. Not tonight." Marcus and I look at each other. He mouths, "What now?" Dad goes, "There's slow surgery, and there's ripping off the band-aid, Sarah." "I said, not tonight." She fixes her eyes on me, and she is not happy. "I need you to pick up Dusty after you're done today."
"From where?"
"From Tam's house." Picking up Dusty or Marcus or anyone is normally the last thing I ever agree to. Try not being able to recognize anyone and then having to go find them. But this morning, I'm not about to argue with my mom.
Libby. Even with half of the bleachers folded up, the new gym is an enormous place. You can barely see the ceiling from the floor, and the lights are blinding. From up above, I would look no larger than an ant. And all at once, that's what I feel like. An ant. My palms are sweating. My heart is clenching, but not unclenching. I can't catch my breath. I watch as it runs out of the gym as fast as it can, just like I want to do. Why in the hell did I volunteer to do this? Heather Alpern and her three squad captains sit in chairs, legs crossed. The squad captains are all seniors, and they look identical, their hair slicked back into ponytails, faces shining. I find their sameness almost as terrifying as Ms. Alpern's cat-like beauty. Most terrifying of all is Caroline Lechamp, captain of the squad captains, who locks her eyes on me like a squid. A few other damsel wannabes are sprinkled along the bottom row of the bleachers, waiting their turns to try out. Caroline says, "Are you ready?" in this super-friendly tone that is completely unnatural. I can barely hear her because I am trapped in my mind and body, shivering and afraid. I suddenly feel like I have face blindness because no one looks familiar or nice, and my eyes are flying all over the gym, searching for help. They land on Bailey, JV, and Iris, at the very top of the bleachers. When they see me looking at them, they go blank, and maybe they can see my terror, which means everyone else can probably see it too. I tell myself to move, to hide that terror and stuff it down and out of sight, and then JV waves her arms and yells, "Shine on, you crazy diamond!" You volunteered to do this because the dance is in you. And then I think of something my mom used to say, about how, as scary as it is to go after dreams, it's even scarier not to. "Are you ready?" Caroline doesn't sound as super friendly this time. "Yes," I say, and then I shout, "Yes!" For my audition song, I chose Flashdance, What a Feeling, by Irene Cara, in honor of my mom, in honor of me. As I wait for the music to begin, I tell myself, too many people in this world think small is the best they can do. Not you, Libby Strout. You weren't born for small. You don't know how to do small. Small is not in you. And then the song takes off, and so do I. Shimmy, shimmy, kick, kick. Shake, boom, boom. It takes me about 20 seconds to forget about the staring faces and all that shiny, pulled-back hair and which of the girls on the bleachers may or may not be a better dancer than I am and the fact that I'm twice as big as anyone in this room. After that first 30 seconds, I disappear into the song. I become one with the music, one with the dance. Kick, bend, twist. Flick, flick, shimmy. Shake, shake, shake. Boom, kick, kick. Pop, twist, bend. Flick, shimmy, shake. Kick, boom, boom, boom. I'm carried away on the notes, across the gym, high up into the rafters, out the doors, and through the school, all the way to Principal Wasserman's office, until I'm outside in the sun, under the sky. Twirl, twirl, twirl. And then I'm in the sky, and now I am the sky. I sail over Amos, across Interstate 70, over into Ohio, and from there to New York, and the Atlantic, and then to England, to France. I'm everywhere. I'm global. I am universal. I end, out of breath, suddenly back in the gym. The girls on the bleachers are standing up and whistling. They clap and stamp their feet, and my friends are the wildest of all. Over by the entrance to the court, I see Jack Maslin, paint-spattered and beaming like the sun. He's slow clapping, and then he taps his forehead in a salute before vanishing. He and the rest of my fellow delinquents are painting the bleachers today. Heather Alpern says, "Libby, that was wonderful." And for the first time, I look directly at her. Caroline goes, "How tall are you?" And something in her loud, flat voice makes my stomach drop. The girls on the bleachers fall quiet and settle back into their seats. "I'm 5'6". "How much do you weigh?" 120 pounds. Everyone stares. "I'm sorry, did you mean my physical weight or my spiritual weight?" The girls on the bleachers giggle. I am dripping, but I dab at my upper lip and the back of my neck as demurely as Queen Elizabeth. "The weight that determines what size costume you would need?" I say, "Is there a weight limit for this squad?" Caroline starts to speak, but Heather Alpern interrupts her. "Technically, there is not a limit. We don't discriminate against size."
"But they do."
I can hear it in the careful way she's picking her words, and I can see it in the tight corners of her smile.
"So why do you need to know my weight?"
Caroline sighs, loudly, like I'm as dumb as a rock.
"For costume size."
Then she smiles this slow movie villain smile.
"Would you be willing to lose weight if you were wanted?"
The word echoes across the court.
"You know, if you were to make the team."
Ms. Alpern shoots her a look. "Caroline."
I say, "How much weight are we talking about?"
Caroline says,
100 pounds. Probably more. 250, maybe?"
Which is ridiculous, because that would mean I'd weigh about the same as my Aunt Tilly's dog, Mango. Like that, I'm a kid again in ballet class, and Caroline is my teacher, frowning at me in the same exact way, a way that tells me I don't belong here, even though I probably belong more than any of them, because the dance is in me. And there's a lot more of me than there is of them, which means there is a lot more dance in there.
"Would you?"
"Caroline, enough."
"You want to know if I'd be willing to lose 200 pounds so that I can dance in formation and carry flags? With you?"
I'm hot with anger, which doesn't help the dripping, but I make my voice quiet and controlled.
"Yes."
I fix my eyes on Ms. Heather Alpern, because she's supposed to be in charge here.
"Absolutely not." I'm supposed to go back outside to the bleachers to serve my sentence and do my civic duty, but I can't. Instead, I call Rachel and ask if she can take me home.
Jack. By the time we finish painting the locker rooms, it's almost 5 p.m. The sky is thick with gray, and the air is heavy, the way it always feels before it rains. Through the wide window of Tam's house, I can see a clump of kids, and I think, great. This is why I don't volunteer to pick Dusty up. Because this, right here, is the stuff of nightmares. I can't find him in a crowd, and my parents think Dusty's too young for a phone, so it's not like I can text him to say I'm coming. Wait outside. The few times I do go get him, I usually wait in the car and blow the horn. Because this apparently isn't a one-on-one Tams and Dusty playdate situation, but the 10-year-old equivalent of Coachella, this is what I do now. The rain pelts the windshield like gunfire. The clump of kids doesn't move, so I honk again. I wait a couple more minutes, and then I turn off the car and twist the rear-view mirror so I can look at myself. The guy who stares back at me has seen better days. He's still got a split lip and an eye that's fading from black and blue to violet, thanks to defending Johnny Rumsford. Super. I search for anything I can use as coverage, from my face and from the monsoon. There's an old jacket, which must belong to Marcus, wadded up on the floor below the back seat. I grab it and lunge out into the rain, jogging up the walk, jacket wrapped around my head. I can hear the mad chatter of 1,000 high-pitched voices as I ring the doorbell. The door flies open, and I'm greeted by a blonde woman with short cropped hair. This, I think, is Tamara's mom. She invites me in, and I say through the jacket, "That's okay. I don't want to bring all this water in. If you could just send him out..." "Nonsense, Jack. Come on in." She holds the door open wider, and the wind is blowing rain onto her and onto the floor around her, so I step inside. "It's really coming down," I say. "You're telling me they were supposed to be outside all day." She laughs, but it's laced with hysteria, and I can see how tired she is. I'm hoping Dusty will yell hello or otherwise identify himself. But the kids all blink at me, and one of them says, "It's like God is peeing." And this must be some really clever 10-year-old joke, the kind you need to be 10 to appreciate, because they all start laughing until they practically fall down. The woman says to me, "Please take me with you." I laugh as I stand there, trying to seem calm and casual and, "Hey man, whatever." Meanwhile, I'm trying to find Dusty and the bunch of kids, but they all look the same. Skinny, short, ears that stick out. All the kids are wearing party hats, and only a handful of them are obviously white. I feel a distant flicker of panic in my chest. The woman says, "Do you want to stay for a bit?" "That's okay. Dusty and I have someplace to be." I put my hand on the doorknob as a way of saying, "See?" I say to the room, "Anyone who answers to the name Dusty better join me now." The kids stare at me. In that instant, the flicker of panic sparks into an inferno. If my brother is one of these staring, silent kids, he's not letting on. I look at the group of them and say in their general direction, "Come on, man. We don't want you to be late." When they don't budge, I zero in on the one who looks the most like my brother. Ears that stick out, Adam's apple that sticks out, copper brown hair, and go, "If you're worried about getting wet, I've got this jacket you can use." And then, because it's been a long day, and I'm sick of being stared at, and because I'm telling myself this is bullshit, how can you not recognize your own brother, I do something I never do. I walk over, leaving big, dirty footprints on the carpet, and grab the kid's arm before he identifies himself, and drag him toward the door. The boy I'm holding on to is fighting me, and it's then I look up and see this other kid walk into the room. He's got ears that stick out, and an Adam's apple that sticks out, and copper brown hair, and he goes, "Jack?" and starts to cry. The kid I've just, until this moment, been dragging away shouts, "Get off me!" Now the other party guests are buzzing, and one of the little girls is crying too. As I let him go, the kid practically spits at me, "Ass face!" and starts shaking. The woman squats down in front of him. She says in this soothing voice, "It's okay, Jeremy. He was just joking around, but I think he realizes now that it wasn't funny." She shoots me a horrible look. "Do you really think it's funny to come in here and scare people?" This is from a little girl with red hair who may or may not be Tam's. "No, I don't." I wonder how many of them know me and how many of their parents will hear about this. I feel like I'm going to be sick, and I almost walk out. Let Dusty find his own way home. Let my mom come get him. But it's as if the floor is holding me there. My feet are like anchors. They won't move. I just stand there, staring past the kids, staring back at me. At the kid who walked in. The one who's still crying. "I'm sorry." I say it directly to him a couple of times, but no one is listening. These kids could kill me if they wanted to. There are so many of them, and small though they be, fury is on their side. An eternity later, the woman stands and says in this cold, cold voice, "That is your brother." Like I'm the world's biggest child predator. She pushes Dusty toward me like she wants both of us gone. Like Dusty, by association, is also guilty. I'm not an ass face. Not in this way, at least. I have a condition called prosopagnosia. It means I can't recognize faces, not even the faces of the people I love. I add, it grows so quickly at this age, makes it hard to keep track of them. And I grab the actual one and only Dusty and drag him outside. I throw the jacket at him, and he drapes it over his head. But it's clear he doesn't want to be near me. So he takes his sweet time coming down the walk. I'm soaked to the bone by now, but I hold the door open for him. And as he gets in, he looks up at me with tears all over his face and says, "Why would you try to kidnap Jeremy Mervis?" I was only joking around. He is studying me the way he does my parents these days, like he's not sure if he can trust me. Fourth grade is hard enough without being known as the brother of a child stealer. My hands are shaking, but I don't want him to see. So I grip the wheel till my knuckles turn white, and then ask him to tell me about the party. I can barely hear him over the sound of my heart as it goes bam, bam, bam against the walls of my chest.
Libby. Rachel wants to know what happened. This is a person who has seen you through your very worst. When you met her, you were taking up 2 hospital beds after being rescued from your house. She has been there for you and loved you through everything, just like a mom. Only she isn't your mom. I tell her I don't want to talk about it, not now, and we ride in silence most of the way home. In my room, I open my copy of We Have Always Lived in the Castle. Even though she's done a terrible, horrific thing, Mary Catherine doesn't feel anything. No pain, or remorse, or emotion. Not even when the villagers trespass across her property and chant songs about her. Maricat said, "Connie, would you like a cup of tea?" "Oh no," said Maricat, "you'll poison me." Maricat said, "Connie, would you like to go to sleep? Down in the boneyard, 10 feet deep?" Maricat is happy enough in her house with her sister for company, but she still thinks about the villagers and wishes their tongues would burn right out of their skulls. I remember being so full of pain and anger that I wished nothing but tongue-burning on everyone who hurt me, especially Moses Hunt. But here's the thing. Maricat poisoned her entire family. The only crime I committed was being fat.
Jack. Why weren't you in the living room with the other kids? I didn't feel like playing their games. I went out to the back porch to study my lines. The crying seems to have stopped, but he won't look at me directly. Did Tams and the others want you to play with them? He shrugs. I don't think they miss me. But everything's cool with Tams, right? He takes a few seconds before each reply, and I can hear the hurt in his voice. The hurt I put there. I guess. I let him be. My mind racing, my heart still going bam, bam, bam. As we pull up in front of the house, Dusty says, Jack? Yeah. I want him to tell me he forgives me, that he loves me anyway. I really wish you hadn't tried to kidnap Jeremy. Me too. What if Tams' mom had called the police? What if they sent you to jail? His voice shakes, and he looks like he's going to cry again. I'm not going to jail. I wouldn't have let them send me to jail. It was just a misunderstanding. That's all it was. I got confused. He gets out of the car without a word, and as we go up the walk, I say, Hey, little man, do you mind not mentioning what happened today to Mom and Dad? The rain has let off, but I can still feel it in the air. He hesitates, and I can tell he doesn't want to promise me anything, ever. He tilts his face upward and latches his eyes onto mine. These are eyes that are shutting me out. They are looking at me, but from very far away. Finally, he says, Okay. After he goes inside, I sit down on the front step, damp as it is, because I'm not ready to go in yet. It's been a long day, and the evening is quiet and cool, like a hand against your forehead when you're running a fever. I stare out at the street, and then up at the sky. My hands are still shaking. My heart is still pounding. Today was really, really bad. Your brain is broken. It will never get better. I can't tell you what Jeremy Mervis looks like. If he was to walk down the street right now, I wouldn't be able to recognize him. But I will never forget the look of terror in his eyes as I tried to drag him out of there. And I will never forget the look on my brother's face as he watched. Today could have been worse. I repeat it over and over, even as I try to think of the five ways it could have been more horrible, but I can't, because really, what's worse than accidentally trying to kidnap some kid you don't know? My mind goes reeling back to Dusty. He's carrying around things that I can never know about, just like I am. Just like we all are. I'm not sure what these things of his are, but I can guess. Dusty's sensitive, he's honest. He's a little eccentric. He's almost certainly gay, but I doubt even he knows it. Like Libby, he's not going to pretend to be someone he's not. And he's not afraid to be different. But other kids won't always like that. I don't believe in God anymore. If I ever did. But out loud I say a kind of prayer. Just keep him safe. Don't let anyone hurt him. And while you're at it, look after Libby and old Johnny Rumsford, too. And my mom. And Marcus. And even Dad. I don't add myself to the list because that feels selfish. But maybe I think it. Just for a minute. And me, I guess. Even if I don't deserve it. Maybe look out for me, too. When I get inside, my mom is on the phone with Tam's mom, and my dad is on the phone with the parents of Jeremy Mervis. So much for secrets. Everyone is apparently very, very pissed. My mom holds up a finger at me. Jack Henry, stay. She points to the living room. 10 minutes later. Mom. What is this about? Me. Maybe I need glasses. I'm not just talking about the Jeremy Mervis kidnapping. I'm talking about all of it, Jack. Getting in trouble at school? Fighting? This isn't you. Me. I've just had a bad run, Mom. I'm the same lovable boy you raised. Still your favorite child. Still me. Mom. I don't know what's happening with this family, but this behavior ends now. If there's something going on, you need to talk to us. And here's my chance to spill it all out onto the floor, right next to the stray piece of popcorn that's poking out from under the couch, and the PlayStation remote lying on the rug. Mom. Jack, tell us what's going on. But in that moment, I don't know what to say. Everything that's wrong with me seems made up, because it's not like I can point to any of it and actually show them. My dad's secret affair, my secret brain disorder. Me. I'm sorry, I'll do better. That's the best I can do. I look at my dad. That's the best any of us can do. And maybe, because he knows some of this might be his fault, my dad says,
I believe you, Jack, but this is pretty bad. You need to make amends with the families.
Mom, we also want you seeing a counselor, Mr. Levine or one of the others. No going out for 2 weeks. School, work, home, that's it. I want to say, 2 weeks? Ground me for the rest of the year. Ground me from school while you're at it. Let me stay at home like Mary Catherine Blackwood, like Libby. We'll make things so much easier. I feel all tied up. Hands, legs, feet. Every single part of me. Like they might as well stuff me in a box and leave me there. I call the Mervises first, and then Tam's mom. In this dead voice, I apologize. I tell them I'm still reeling from my dad's cancer, from all the stuff happening at school. I say, please don't punish Dusty for my bad behavior. He's the best person I know. As I hang up the phone, I add a postscript to my prayer. Don't let anyone hurt him, including me.
Libby. I don't feel like dancing, but I get out the pink toe shoes and tie them on. I drop onto my bed and lean against the pillows and pull George onto my chest, inhaling a mouthful of musty fur. He starts kicking, so I let him go, and then he does something he's never done before. He sits beside me, petting me with his sharp, dirty little claws. I cross my ankles so that I can see my toe shoes as I'm staring at the wall. For a minute, this feels like old times, lying in bed, locked away from everyone. I pretend I'm in my old house, across the street from Dean, Sam, and Castiel, my imaginary friends who were never actually my friends at all. I'm Libby Strout, America's fattest teen. Maybe the world's saddest teen, alone in her room with her cat, while outside that room, the rest of the world goes on.
Jack. The night is cool and clear after the rain. I inch my way to the edge of the roof until I'm standing where I was standing before, 12 years ago. And I look out over the neighborhood and the house that used to belong to Libby Strout. Maybe if I fell again, it would jar something back into place in my brain. I might see the world and the people in it in ways I don't now. I might conjure up a face from my memory, or be able to think, Mom, and instantly associate the word with a whole added-up image of eyes, nose, mouth, the way everyone else does. I stand there for a long time, trying to figure out a way to jump and bang my head in the same exact spot I hit it before. Maybe I should take a rock and hit myself with it instead. But what if I do more damage? What if I get complete and total amnesia? I sit down, and then I lie down. And the roof is damp from the rain. I let the water soak through my shirt as I gaze at the sky, and all the stars that look just like all the other stars. And it might as well be a sky full of faces. I tell myself, Libby is one of those stars. I choose one and name it after her, and keep my eyes on it as long as I can. And then I blink. Stay. 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 Don't go away. But she's gone.
Libby. The phone rings and it's Jack, the only person I want to talk to. Something's wrong. I can hear it in his voice. At first I can't understand what he's saying. I'm sorry, he says. He keeps repeating it until I tell him to stop. Why are you sorry? What's going on?
I can't do this. I thought I could. I wanted to. But I can't. It's not fair to you.
What's not? You deserve to be seen, and I'll never be able to see you. Not really. What happens if you lose weight? You'd need to stay large forever, and that's your identifier. But you're so much more than weight.
What are you saying to me, Jack? Even though I know, and my stomach knows, and my bones know, and most of all, my heart knows. All of me is sinking like a stone. He says, I can't be with you, Libby. We can't do this. I'm sorry.
And then he hangs up. Just like that. And I sink through the floor, and into the yard, and from there into the dark, deep core of the earth. I think of Beatrice in her garden, and how she died for love. And then for some reason I think of another story my mom used to read me, The 12 Dancing Princesses. I walk to my bookshelf and search for it. I flip through until I find it, Libby in purple crayon. I wrote it very small, on the skirt of the youngest princess, Elise. She was my favorite, not just because she wins the prince, but because she has the loveliest heart. She is who I wanted to be. I look at Elise's perfect hair and face and figure. Of course people love to watch her dance. Of course she marries the prince. I wonder what would have happened if Elise had looked like me.
Jack. Before I go to sleep, I write Libby this long apology text. But I end up deleting it because, what's the point? It won't change the fact that there will always be this part of me that's searching for her. Even if she's right there.
The week after. Libby. Even though I don't expect to make the team, I still go around to Heather Alpern's office to see if she's posted the name of the newest damsel. And there's the paper on her door. And there's the single name listed on that paper. Giselle Villegas. I tell myself, you shouldn't be surprised. You shouldn't be disappointed. What did you think would happen when you talked back to Caroline? But I am surprised. I am disappointed. I tell myself, you didn't really want to make the damsels anyway. Not like that. Not having to dance in formation and carry flags and take orders from Caroline Luchamp. But my heart feels like a deflated balloon. Bailey and Travis and I wait outside for Mr. Dominguez to pull the car around. Travis's eyes are closed, and he looks like he's sleeping standing up. Bailey says, I heard about Giselle. It's okay. I'm okay. Just to drive the point home of how completely okay I am, I wave my hand at the air, so carefree, like I'm smacking away a mosquito. She says, it's that horrible Caroline. This will just free me up to pursue other things. Like dancing by myself in my room and creating voodoo dolls with Caroline Luchamp's face. As I fish through my backpack for a lip gloss, Bailey is listing all the other non-dancing, non-voodoo doll-making activities I could start doing. My hand closes around something. An envelope. I yank it out and turn away to read it, even though I can guess what it says. You aren't wanted. I told you so. I look up, expecting Caroline to be there watching me. Instead, Bailey is reading over my shoulder. Who's that from? No one. I shove the letter back into my backpack. I told you so. Does she mean, see there, Jack doesn't love you? Or does she mean, why did you ever think you could audition for the damsels? Lips, who wrote that? Don't worry about it. But, please, Bailey, I'm fine. I guess you're fine about Jack, too, then.
I don't want to talk about Jack!
Her mouth snaps shut. Then she says, You can't always be fine. No one's always fine. And I know you're used to being on your own, and I know I should have been a better friend, so that you didn't have to get used to being on your own, but I'm here now, and I wish you'd talk to me. In the car, I ask Mr. Dominguez to, for God's sake, play some music, only I don't actually mention God because this will only set Bailey off, and I already feel bad enough for barking at her. The first song Mr. Dominguez chooses is, of course, ancient 1970s rock. Love Hurts. And if you don't know it, don't ever listen to it. Especially if your heart is broken. Immediately, I get this lump in my throat. The kind that makes it impossible to swallow or even breathe. 1 minute into the song, tears are rolling down my face, but Mr. Dominguez doesn't bat an eye. I see Jack in the main hallway of school. He's flanked by Seth Powell and Dave Kaminsky, who looks right at me, almost through me, while Jack saunters past like I'm invisible. And maybe I am, like everyone else in his life. Just one more person he can't see.
Jack. Conversation circle is canceled today because Mr. Levine has some sort of staff meeting. And honestly, I'm glad. I don't want to face Libby because I'm a miserable coward. And this is what miserable cowards do. We avoid facing things. I walk out of school with Cam, who's going, "What are you up to tonight? I hear Kendra's having some people over." I can picture tonight like it's already happened. Kendra's enormous house, filled with yapping dogs no higher than your ankle. Caroline and the rest of them bitching about one thing and another. Everyone drinking till they're stupid. Man, I'm still grounded. Not that I would go if I could. He starts telling me a story about Seth, but I'm only half listening because a car comes pulling up, and I watch as this girl who can only be Libby climbs in. The car rolls away, and I'm thinking, look up. Look up. But she doesn't even glance in my direction. I find Mom with hair down in the kitchen, standing in front of the window, drinking one of Dusty's juice boxes. She looks distracted and far away. I walk in coughing so I can give her fair warning. She smiles, but it lands somewhere over my left shoulder. What's up? Just thirsty. I grab a juice box and lean against the counter. Do you remember when I was playing Little League? Sure. You would tell me who all the players were before practice because I could never keep them straight. You were always getting them mixed up. It was pretty cool of you to do that. That's what we do. She says it so matter-of-factly that I love her more for it. She smiles into the distance, into the past, and laughs. You were full of swagger even then. I'm not sure where that came from. You didn't get it from us. I totally got it from you. She smiles, sighs. So what's really up? Are you and Dad getting divorced? What? Why would he say that? This is my strong, no-bullshit mother. There's something scared hidden deep in her voice. Like I may know something she doesn't. It's like a knife through the gut, and I wish I'd never heard it because there's no way I'm going to forget the sound of it. Not if I live to be 100. You guys just don't seem like you lately. Things have been a little strained. She is wary. It's in her face and in her voice. It's in the way she crosses her arms over her chest. But you're the child and I'm the parent. No matter how tall you get or how large you grow that afro, which means I don't want you to worry. Her smile is the punctuation, the thing that tells me we're done here. There's something in its protectiveness that brings on this wave of deja vu, and suddenly I'm 6 years old and lying in the hospital. My mom is holding my hand. She's talking to my dad, and they're happy and relieved because I'm going to be okay. And he doesn't have cancer yet. And he hasn't even met Monica Chapman. Mom glances at me and then back at my dad. And her face seems different every time. Is this when it started? But her smile is the same. And now, standing in our kitchen, I'm thinking about Dr. Oliver Sacks, who believed that the recognition of faces doesn't depend solely